Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. And there is nobody whose judgment and insights and reporting on various aspects of that war I value more than our first guest. He is Bill Gertz. He is the prize-winning columnist at the Washington Times for his Inside the Ring column. He is also senior editor of the Washington Free Beacon and a many times over best-selling author, including his new book, Eye Wars, War and Peace in the Information Age. Bill, it's good to have you, sir. Welcome back.
Hi, Frank. Good to be on the program.
Well, I hardly know where to begin, Bill. There's so much going on that you're covering so well. Let me ask you first and foremost about the China Commission, the U.S. Congress's Economic and Security Review Commission involving China, an incredibly important second opinion, I think of it as, on what's going on there. What's the latest upshot of its report?
Yeah, the annual report from the U.S.-China Commission came out this week, and it was chock full of really powerful information in identifying the growing threat from China's military, as well as the economic threat. It looked at all of the Chinese investment in the United States, the trade imbalance, which, of course, the Trump administration is focused on like a laser. But in terms of Chinese weapons development, for the first time, the annual report highlighted the advanced weaponry development by China. And that includes a lot of the exotic weapons, which include maneuvering warheads, hypersonic missiles, electromagnetic rail guns, space warfare weapons, and the like. And it said that in all of these areas, China is basically ahead of the United States, and that the U.S. is facing a kind of an effort by China to equal the United States, but to develop what they call leap-ahead technologies, which would give them an asymmetric advantage. And that can be used, as we know, for coercion against American allies in Asia, as well as in a future conflict with the United States, giving them these trump card weapons.
In a manner of speaking. Bill Gertz, one of the areas in which they are clearly engaged in activity that is aimed at coercing us is in connection with suppressing dissidents who have found their way into this country. Talk a little bit about this fellow Guo Wengui and the China Commission's assessment of what's happening in his case.
Yeah, the China Commission had a lengthy box of information about this billionaire dissident. He's living in New York. He's broken with the regime, and he began speaking out earlier this year to highlight high-level government corruption in China. And this has triggered what the commission report calls an unprecedented disinformation and information operation campaign in an effort to silence him. And the effort included using a Chinese security official who's ahead of the Interpol, the International Police Organization, to issue what they call a red notice. It's tantamount to an international request for arrest. And of course, a lot of rogue states like Russia and China have been using Interpol to go after dissidents and journalists and others. And that seems to be the case here. In addition to that, there have been cyber attacks against Guo. Now, I've never seen anything like this going back to, say, the KGB days when they did active measures and disinformation campaigns as a matter of state policy. Here you have a case study in China doing disinformation operations in order to silence a regime critic.
Yeah. And it sounds as though they have been successful in getting the Voice of America to join them in that effort. Talk a little bit about that, Bill Gertz.
Oh, yeah. This is a real surprising story. The Voice of America did a interview with Guo that was scheduled to be a 3-hour live interview last April. In the middle of the interview was cut off. and four employees, three of whom are now being slated for dismissal by VOA for doing an interview with Guo. And this comes amid intense Chinese diplomatic pressure on the State Department and VOA, basically the embassy going to the top leadership. And this is really a bad indication that our official Voice of America radio has been suborned by the Chinese government.
Yeah, you talk about eye war. There it is. A surrender on our part. These are government employees, after all, and they're being not only silenced, but put out to pasture. It's unbelievable. But Bill, let me turn to one other unbelievable development. Well, I warned about it at the time we signed the Intermediate Range Nuclear Force Agreement, that it was likely to be violated by the Russians, then doing business as the Soviet Union, but now under Vladimir Putin, Soviet Union 2.0, I guess I think of it as. General Valery Gerasimov, the top military officer in the Russian Federation's military, made an interesting admission the other day. Talk a little bit about it and the INF Treaty, as it's known.
Yeah, this was a discovery by Dr. Mark Schneider, who is a former Pentagon nuclear policymaker, and he discovered this recent report in the state-run Russian media quoting Gerasimov as saying that a number of units of missiles, ground-based missiles with ranges of 3,400 miles or more, are set for deployment. So this is a new and second INF treaty violation, the first being a ground-launched cruise missile, which has been tested a number of times. So you have two violations of the INF treaty, and of course, during the Obama administration, this entire militarily significant, I want to stress, arms treaty violation had been ignored and covered up. The Congress has moved swiftly. They have $58 million. The Wall Street Journal just reported that work has begun on a new U.S. INF missile in order to counteract this violation. But again, it could take years before that comes into play. I think they're also looking at developing new or advanced missile defenses against these new INF missiles that the Russians are deploying.
Yeah, I was working, as you know, Bill Gertz, in the Pentagon at the time the INF treaty was negotiated. In fact, participated in helping that happen, but was very concerned that we were giving up capabilities that would protect our forces in Europe, our allies there, and that the Russians would, in fact, do what they've done now, which is once all of these forces that we had deployed, the Pershings and the ground-launched cruise missiles, were removed and destroyed, simply reintroduce new capabilities of their own. And it's a threat, it seems to me, not only to our friends and allies and forces in Europe, but also in Asia. So I'm hoping that something will come of all of this effort to respond. Bill, quickly, there's also an important report by you about the rising sophistication, aggressiveness, and disruptive capabilities of cyber attacks against this country. I had a member of Congress recently tell me of briefings that he had received that are very shocking on this front. Quickly, can you tell us what is afoot there and whether it's new news and ominous?
Yeah, this was based on a speech given just this week by a senior National Security Agency official, John Darby, who's deputy chief of the cybersecurity section at NSA. And it was a fairly blunt and candid assessment of the growing threat of cyber attacks. And those attacks are increasing in both sophistication, in scale, in aggressiveness, and disruptiveness. What Darby said was that we're seeing states like Russia and China, the advanced cases, along with Iran and North Korea, also taking cyber attack tools that are, quote, out in the wild and repurposing those, using those to conduct cyber attacks, such things as ransomware, all focused on getting inside networks. The big threat is that these advanced actors, Russia and China, are getting into a host of networks and are planting software that could be used to shut down those networks in a future crisis or conflict.
Yeah, and that's to say nothing of this the use of Russian software that almost certainly creates new opportunities for this kind of attack upon us. Bill Gertz, so much more to talk with you about. Thank you for the terrific work you do at the Washington Times and Washington Free Beacon. Thank you, too, for joining us for our Keeper of the Flame dinner this week. For those of you who missed it, I would commend to you the video that's available now at securefreedom.org. It was an extraordinary event. I think you'll agree, Bill, and it was, as always, great to have you in the room. Thank you for joining us today as well. We'll talk with you again next week. Have a good weekend, my friend. Next up, we will speak with Luis Fleischmann about developments in Venezuela and what they might mean for our interests there and beyond. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are joined by my friend and colleague at the Center for Security Policy, its senior advisor to our Mengus Hemispheric Security Project. He is Dr. Luis Fleischmann, the editor of the Mengus Project's America's Report, an invaluable resource on what is happening in the Latin American region and what it means for us here at home. He is the author, most recently, of Latin America in the Post-Chavez Age, The Security Threat to the United States, and always a welcome guest here. Luis, thank you very much for joining us.
Always a pleasure to be here with you, Frank.
You have been writing about a rather remarkable thing, I have to say. That is the fundamental transformation, I guess, of a fellow by the name of Luis Almagro, the Secretary General of the Organization of American States, at least with respect to the escalating crisis in Venezuela. Tell us a little bit about him and the role he's currently playing and whether it might make a difference in the future situation with respect to Venezuela.
Well, Frank, Luis Almagro has been one of the most pleasant surprises we have had in this tumultuous world called Latin America and the region. Luis Almagro is a former foreign minister for José Mujica. José Mujica is a former president of Uruguay that basically supported Chavez and supported Castro.
So he was playing for the wrong team in that period, at least.
That is correct. He was playing for the wrong team. And when he was elected the Secretary General of the Organization of American States, I was even interviewed by one of the papers in Latin America asking me, what do I think about the appointment of Almagro? I said, well, he is going to be worse than the previous one in Sulsa, who basically was totally subordinated to the what is called the left, and including the extreme left, such as Hugo Chavez. It happened to be that Mr. Almagro, once he received that position in the Organization of American States, he totally moved, became the number one and the champion of fighting for human rights and regime change in Venezuela, and that was remarkable, even though he has not had enough support from his bosses.
What kind of response is he getting from others in the organization, for that matter, including our own government?
Well, it is my impression that behind the scenes, I think many of the presidents or the leaders of the different Latin American countries support Almagro's actions, but very much behind the scenes. In other words, when you say behind the scenes, means there are no enough denunciations, there is not enough action to impose sanctions on Venezuela. And by the way, Almagro, I had the opportunity to have dinner with him a couple of weeks ago, and I also heard him in public speeches in Miami. And he basically told me that sanctions, and he told also the public in general, that sanctions is the response. Sanctions is the response and must come from the United States and European Union. And what he told me basically, what he told us in public and also in private is that the only ones capable of basically bringing that change, making changes in that regime, or at least in the behavior of that regime, are the Americans.
Okay. Again, Luis, the problem with that, of course, as you know so well, is that there are many in Latin America, even governments that are now on the right, that have come about as a result of repudiation of the Chavistas in Latin American country after country, that, you know, you can't align yourselves with the you know, the gringos, the Americans. And so I assume that's probably why many of these governments, if they are aligning themselves more or less with an anti-Chavez line, are unwilling to do so publicly. But can you get past that lingering problem in the region, do you think? And if so, is Luis Almagro the man to try to help bring it about?
Yes, I think so. And at this point, you know, the problem with countries in Latin America is that they are willing to talk, but most of their talk is about they call on the Venezuelan government to hold elections and to, you know, democratize the regime. This is an empty statement because the Venezuelan regime is a totalitarian state. It's a totalitarian state. And totalitarian states usually don't give up. It's like asking Hitler to give up anti-Semitism or asking Stalin to give up communism or democratizing.
They use elections to get into power. They don't use elections to lose it, right?
Correct. And the elections at this point are fraudulent. So, and on the other hand, the Latin American countries are not willing to take the step forward of isolating Venezuela the way they should. So the appearance of Luis Almagro with Nikki Haley next to him at the Security Council, I think, was extremely important.
Nikki Haley, of course, being our ambassador to the United Nations.
Now, we're ambassador to the United Nations, and for the first time, I heard from an American voice saying that the United, that Venezuela is not only a threat to their own, to its own citizens, but also to the United States and the region. And that is something that, that at the CSP, at the Center for Security Policy, we've been saying it for more than a decade now, a decade and a half, almost two.
Very, very volubly, thanks to, in no small measure, to your help. But this is also noteworthy, is it not, Luis Fleischmann, because Nikki Haley's message is very much at odds with the kind of line that has been promoted by Thomas Shannon, a Foreign Service officer and longtime denizen of the senior ranks of the State Department, who has been very much under successive presidents, you know, pushing back on the truth as we've been telling it, and now Nikki Haley is as well. Does this mean that his star is finally fading in the Trump administration, do you think?
Well, yes, I hope so. I hope so. The only problem is, and you know, since there are not enough appointments at this point in the State Department, like for instance, we don't have an undersecretary of states for Latin American affairs that can have, let's say, control and be loyal to the right policies.
Namely the ones that Donald Trump seems to want to follow and Nikki Haley is describing.
That's correct. And so Donald Trump, in my opinion, needs to appoint people that actually go along with this line of thinking. Otherwise, Thomas Shannon will survive there forever. I know that now he was appointed to be somewhere in the climate change or whatever. But in any event, the Thomas Shannon survived in the State Department because there was not enough attention paid by the White House, or the wrong attention, let's say, paid by the White House on what is going on. So eventually Thomas Shannon became the architect of that failed policy of being complacent with the Venezuelans and with the Cubans, when in fact they are our enemies. I've never seen such a self-inflicted wound as the State Department under Shannon actually has done. So I'm happy to see him gone.
Dr. Luis Fleischmann, there's so much more to talk about, not least the apparent the approaching bankruptcy of Venezuela and its implications, whether there will be bailouts by some of the regimes. You mentioned the Cubanos who are in there propping up the regime, but perhaps the Russians and the Chinese or Iranians will do more of the same. I know you'll be tracking all of this closely at the Mengus Hemispheric Security Project, and therefore the rest of us who are consumers of the America's Report will be the smarter for it. We'll look forward to watching what you produce there and to having you back very soon. In the meantime, thank you. Stay well. Luis, have a good weekend. Next up, we'll talk with Dr. Harold Rode about how the Islamic mode of warfare is playing out in today's world and what it means for you. That and more, straight ahead.
visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. Our guest is Dr. Harold Rode, a man I've come to know and admire greatly over the decades for his service in the senior ranks of the United States Defense Department. He was, among other things, the sort of duty officer on Turkey and the Middle East more generally, notably in the highly esteemed office of Dr. Andy Marshall in the Office of Net Assessment. These days, he is a distinguished senior fellow at the Gatestone Institute, an outfit I consider to be an absolutely indispensable online resource. He is also the author of a recent book by the Center for Security Policy Press entitled Modern Islamic Warfare, An Ancient Doctrine Marches On. Dr. Rode, welcome back. It's so good to have you.
Great to be here, Frank. Nice to hear your voice.
Thank you. Well, I want to talk about this ancient doctrine marching on, notably at the moment in Syria. I think we can safely begin now to discuss it as post-ISIS Syria. The last vestiges of the one-time caliphate there seems to be pretty much policed up. But Harold Rode, I wonder whether the vacuum that's thus created and the help that we've given to Iran to fill it is not teeing up the next regional war at their very best, and possibly one that will have much farther reaches than that. What are your thoughts on what's happening there at the moment?
We have two major enemies in the Middle East. One is ISIS and groups like it, because when ISIS is finished, a new group will come up. That's the way Islamic warfare works. And the other is the extremist Iranian Shiite government. And it'd be very nice if the two of them want to fight each other. And since we've gone after one, ISIS, but they're both a problem. And if we don't then go after the Iranian government and work for regime change, then it's just a continuation of the problem we have, the forces of evil taking over the Middle East.
An exacerbation of it, arguably, because this is a much more formidable adversary than ISIS ever was. But Harold Rode, am I overstating the case to suggest that the United States has militarily been aiding the Iranians, or at the very least their proxies, notably the Iranian backed Shiite militias in Iraq, but also, to some extent at least, the people that are bringing ISIS to heel in Syria as well?
I think the problem is that the American establishment at the State Department, at the CIA, and a lot at the Pentagon as well, they really don't understand the culture of the Middle East. And Middle Easterners are very charming, very good at smiling and laughing, not laughing, and making you feel good. And they look right in your face, and they lie to you. And the American culture is not used. You don't look someone in the face and lie. If you're going to lie, you look away or you blink your eyes or something. And we are very easily taken in. I don't understand American policy. Never have, frankly. Because these people don't know the languages and the cultures. And when you don't know another culture, it's very easy to be taken in, swayed by it. And that's what's happened. It's sad.
It is indeed. Sad is the least of it in a way. It could be really tragic, especially if we see Israel responding to the rising presence and threat posed by Iran in Syria as the next flashpoint, as I say, for something pretty horrific. Harold, let me switch gears. One of the folks that you have followed closely as a duty expert on Turkey is Recep Tayyip Erdogan, the man who has now become its president and seemingly has created conditions under which he is its absolute ruler. I know you were listening to Steve Bannon recently talking about the danger this individual represents. What can you share with us about his government, its direction, and particular concern to me is his post-allied role with the United States, even though his country remains a member of NATO.
I like how you call him a post-ally. Turkey is buying weaponry from Russia. It's deeply involved with Russia, whatever our relationship is with it. Erdogan is doing many things which, if you're part of the NATO alliance, are unacceptable.
And that means that we should call him on the carpet for that. Now, there are many people who believe that he's one of the most dangerous leaders in the world. And I think in one level that is. And here's why. Erdogan says all sorts of nice things to us. We, you know, we are obsessed with labeling people moderates, which is what we did when we basically helped him come to power in Turkey. We got a moderate ruler. Moderate means that I will get to my goal of Islamifying Turkey and the entire march and have him conquer Europe, have Islam conquer Europe. But I'll do it in a more slyly and quietly and gradual way. I think, was it George Bush Sr., as president, talked about lighting 1,000 lights of candles and then gradually points of light, and you constantly add one more and add one more. And when you add one more and add one more, you don't realize what's going on around you. And that's what the man has been doing since he took over power in Turkey. It's antithetical to American interests and things that we believe in here in the United States.
Absolutely. The difference, of course, of the benign charities that I think was the context in which George H.W. Bush talked about those 1,000 points of light is it's more like 1,000 points leading to a conflagration when you talk about what Erdogan is up to. Let's talk, if you would, Harold, about Qatar in this regard. Qatar, of course, has now become the outcast from the Gulf Cooperation Council, led by the Saudis primarily. Erdogan seems to be determined to ride to the Qataris' rescue. Remind us of the role the Qataris are playing that is causing us such problems, and why anybody helping them is actually not on our side, that's for sure.
Look, here's the bottom line of Qatar. They have a TV station in Arabic called Al Jazeera. Jazeera in Arabic means the peninsula or the island. And the whole Arabian Peninsula, all the little sheikhdoms that are there, and Saudi Arabia and Yemen, is called in Arabic Jazeera al-Arab, the peninsula of the Arabs. And by taking that name for their TV station, they are in essence, shall we say, if I could say very politely, putting their finger up in the face of the Saudis. They're bad actors. Now, to balance this, to neutralize the United States, they let America build a base there, which I think is about could cost about $10 billion to do. And it's like, oh, now the Americans, oh my God, we can't do anything to hurt Qatar. We have our base there. Unfortunately, the result is they've neutralized this beautifully. Qatar wants to do anything which is anti-Saudi. And in this case, that it, who is the real Saudi, the biggest Saudi enemies are the Iranians and, for that matter, the Turks. And here's why. Even though both the Turks and the Saudi government are Sunnis, the Qataris support the what is called the Muslim Brotherhood. And Erdogan is a supporter of the Muslim Brotherhood. Now, the Saudis, for a long period of time, were also a supporter of it. But what happened is that the Brotherhood is slowly but surely also trying to overthrow the Saudi regime. Well, that, of course, is not acceptable to the Saudis. And you now have this huge war of which type of fundamentalism is correct, the Saudi version or the Qatari Turkish version. And so they're at war with each other. And as far as we're concerned, it's a very good idea. Let them be at war.
Yeah, let's help, in other words, them kill each other off, I guess, is what it comes down to. You put the Iranians in the mix, they've got their own agenda, of course, Harold Rode, and all of it has at its core Sharia supremacism and what you've called the modern Islamic warfare doctrine, and the fact that it is very much on the march at the moment, we ignore at our extreme peril. Harold Rode, we're so grateful to you for your clarity on that point, and I commend everyone again. Harold's terrific monograph, Modern Islamic Warfare, An Ancient Doctrine Marches On. And you can find his writings, of course, at the Gatestone Institute. Check it out there and do come back to us very soon again, Harold, if you would. It's great to talk with you and hope to do so in the near future. We're going to talk next, speaking of Bannon, with Morton Klein, the president of the Zionist Organization of America, who's under assault at the moment for having Steve Bannon speak at his conference last weekend. That and much more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. I'm very pleased to say we have been joined by Morten Klein, a man who I hold in such high regard that we have worked closely with him for decades as he has led with courage and clarity and the most incredible tenacity, an organization that I consider to be one of the most important in the country, the Zionist Organization of America. He has been recognized, among other things, with the Center for Security Policy's Keeper of the Flame Award for his leadership of the ZOA and indeed his role in the public policy debate about so many issues, many of them involving American interests as well as those of the State of Israel. I was, well, I can only say shocked to read in the New York Times yesterday a column by Brett Stevens that simply tore in to Mort Klein and the Zionist Organization of America. And one of its guests at a fabulous dinner they had in New York City last weekend involving, among many others, Steve Bannon. I wanted to get Mort's assessment of this diatribe against him and his organization and his guest, and to express my strong solidarity with you, Mort, for both what you did on that occasion and Steve's remarks and more generally your leadership. So thank you for joining us to talk about all of that. Welcome back.
Well, I just got back from Washington where I attended your fabulous, really fabulous gala. Where you honored Senator Ted Cruz. I'll tell you, the highest quality people attending that gala. I could tell by the suits and the jewelry. So it was really a pleasure.
It was actually what's between their ears that makes them high quality. But I was so pleased you were part of it, Mort, as well. It was great to be able to honor you at it last year and to get to do so with Senator Cruz and others from Texas this weekend. Let me talk to you a bit about this bit by Stevens. What's up with that? Talk, if you would, about what Steve Bannon said that seems to have set him off and why.
Well, Brett Stevens, I regret to say this, who was an outstanding journalist for the Wall Street Journal, wrote fabulous articles on all sorts of issues, including Israel, tremendous supporter of Israel, has apparently sold his soul and his principles to the New York Times because since he's been at the New York Times, he's become clearly to the far left of center, condemning and attacking Trump regularly. I've never seen a single article supporting Israel anymore. And his latest astonishing, breathtaking diatribe against the fact that we had Steve Bannon at our dinner. It doesn't mention that we also had Alan Dershowitz, Senator Joe Lieberman, Ambassador David Treben to Israel, and Senator Tom Cotton. That's not mentioned. And he says the reason that he's upset that we had him is he claims that Steve Bannon is an anti-Semitic Zionist and who cavorts with anti-Semites and neo-Nazis, all of which is rubbish. Alan Dershowitz has written that there's nothing anti-Semitic about Bannon, and he's a great supporter of Israel. It's Alan Dershowitz. The ADL wrote that they haven't found a single thing that Bannon has said or written that's anti-Semitic. Dennis Prager said that they're calling him an anti-Semite is simply a libel. So this is nonsense. The opening statement he made at our dinner is, I am proud to be a Christian Zionist. Bannon has helped us with anti-Semitism problems on college campuses around the country by having his reporters covered and calling his officials at those colleges, asking what they're going to do about it.
He's, in short, a friend of Israel, a friend of the Jewish people, a stalwart patriot, and this is a libel, it seems to me.
And he's not a neo-Nazi. On 60 Minutes, Steve Bannon condemned by explicitly neo-Nazis, white supremacists, neo-Confederates, and the Ku Klux Klan, saying they have no place in our country. Brett Stevens said he cavorts, that Bannon cavorts with such people, which is a total lie. I even checked some of the quotes he had, statements he had in his article. Completely false. He made it up. He made it up. This is a journalist. I'm shocked by Brett Stevens. And you know, it's interesting. He goes on this show on MSNBC, sitting and smiling and cavorting with Al Sharpton, an anti-Semite, a terrorism promoter, and a hater of Israel. He called Israel hell.
And I guess by association, guilt by association, we should say, if you're sitting with Al Sharpton, maybe you're a disgrace.
Yeah. Well, this seemed to me to be a disgraceful, you know, act of sort of character assassination. And I, too, have been an admirer of Brett's in the past. I helped our friend Sarah Stern at the Endowment for Middle East Truth give him an award a few years ago, as a matter of fact. It's just stunning that he's unleashed this kind of vitriol against you. Mort, you are no newcomer, of course, to ad hominem attacks against you. And one of the things that I've admired so much about your leadership at the Zionist Organization of America and the contribution that that organization has made, as I say, for decades now, is the clarity that you've brought to the so-called Middle East peace process. I know that you have been working on it to try to help this administration get things right. I must say that I'm concerned when I hear that they're going to come up with some new initiative to try to broker peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians, when I fear there's really no peace to be had with Sharia supremacists of the Fatah, or for that matter, the Hamas character. Give us a sense of where you think things stand with the Trump administration and your attitude towards what they're trying to do.
Well, I think this is really utter foolishness to think that any peace can be had between the Palestinian Arabs and Israel. I mean, the Palestinian Arabs continue to name schools, streets, and sports teams after Jew-killing terrorists. They continue to promote murder and terrorism and violence against Jews in their media, in their speeches, in their sermons, everywhere. They still honor terrorists by having posters of them after they kill Jews all over the schools and the high schools. They honor them. They glorify them.
My understanding is they're using American tax dollars for some of this adulation and enabling of these jihadists. Is that right?
People don't know this. We give them $450 million of U.S. taxpayer dollars a year. They take $355 million of it a year. They pay Arabs and their families who have murdered Jews a lifetime pension if they've killed a Jew. And the more Jews they've killed, the higher the pension.
And the proselytizing of this kind of jihadism among their school children, I believe we're supporting as well.
They chant phrases about the taking back all of Israel, that's their land, and that they support being a martyr, which means being a suicide bomber.
So these are not the ideal partners for peace. And yet the Trump administration, Jared Kushner is supposedly on point about this, seemed nonetheless to be angling to try to have some kind of American initiative here. Mort, I know you've been very critical of efforts by the United States in the past to kind of impose a solution on the parties. Do you think that may be what's in store now as well?
No, I think what's going to happen, they're going to make them an offer. I don't know what the offer is. I do believe any offer they make them will have to be with Israel's consent. And so whatever Israel will consent as an offer will not be an offer that they will ever accept. Look, Ehud Olmert offered them almost all of Judea and Samaria, the West Bank, Eastern Jerusalem, tons of money and statehood. They said no, because they won't accept Israel within any borders. That's why they won't accept the deal, because they'll be forced to sign a document saying they accept Israel as a Jewish state. What we should be doing is saying the jig is up. We're not going to give you any more money. We're not going to support you in any way until you rescind the names of school streets and support you to terrorists. You stop paying Arabs to murder Jews. And you stop promoting hatred and violence. And you have to do that for 1 year. That's what we should say.
Well, and I would like to add to that litany, and I think you're absolutely right as far as it goes. You have to actually embrace the idea that the state of Israel is legitimate and permanent and something that you would agree to live side by side with. I don't see any of that happening, Mort Klein, and I know you will hold them accountable for it if that's not the case. God bless you for your work, and thank you for your efforts with our mutual friend Steve Bannon and otherwise to protect the state of Israel and to help the rest of us understand how important it is to our own security as well.
Thank you. I'm proud to be called Steve Bannon and Frank Gaffney, my friend. You're two of the greatest Christian Zionists in the United States of America. God bless you.
Thanks to you and to all of our team. I'm going to talk next with Liz Yore about the phenomenon of female genital mutilation in America. That and more, straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined, I'm very pleased to say, by Lizabeth Yore. She is an attorney and highly regarded advocate for international children's rights, that is to say, globally, not just here in the United States. I've come to know her through her work as the head of a terrific campaign entitled End FGM Today. That stands, of course, for Female Genital Mutilation. I'm so impressed by Liz and the work of her campaign and by the need for such an effort to end this scourge as it is being more and more revealed in the course of a highly, highly important prosecution by the federal government in Michigan at the moment. Indeed, we catch up with Liz on the eve of an important development in that case, a ruling expected by the judge. We'll talk about it and its implications with her. But first, let me extend a proper welcome. Elizabeth Yore, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, Frank, thank you for having me. It's a delight to be with you today.
Well, it's our pleasure, needless to say, because we're very, very concerned about what's happening in our own country. And Liz, just to calibrate on this, of course, the case in Michigan is a prime focus at the moment, but give us a little context, if you would, first about what is involved in female genital mutilation, and then the extent to which this thing, which if we think about it at all, most of us assume is happening someplace else, but the evidence that it really is a serious scourge here as well.
It is. It has been imported to the United States, Frank. And according to the Center for Disease Control, they estimate that over 500,000 women and girls are at risk of this brutal procedure in the United States alone. I think that's grossly underrepresented. But female genital mutilation, there's four different forms. The least intrusive but most heinous type 1 procedure is a cutting away, a mutilation of the clitoris head of a child, of a little girl from age 5 to 12. This procedure is done. And the purpose is, it's a, you know, a religious practice that is practiced around the world. And according to UNICEF, the World Health Organization, over 200 million girls have been subjected to this procedure. And its purpose, Frank, is to reduce any sexual feeling with respect to sexual relations. It is to, quote unquote, purify a girl.
Let me ask you, at the risk of getting pretty ghoulish about all of this, you mentioned that the least invasive form of this involves removing either in whole or in part the clitoris. There are obviously worse forms of this that are much more draconian. How bad can it get? And also, Liz, if you would, just some say, well, this is just involving a nick of the clitoris. This is not that invasive. It's kind of like male circumcision or something. Would you talk about those two points?
Sure. How bad can it get? Excellent question. And it is practiced according to this way. Little girls are literally sewn up. Their genitals are sewn up with a small hole to urinate. As a result of this, these little girls have infections, you know, become quite sick, are hospitalized. The consequences are physical and emotional, last a lifetime. They're brought into emergency rooms, Frank, because of the complications of this procedure.
Because sometimes it's done in the most crude manner and involves a lot of cutting, some say with broken bottles and the like, and without anesthetics. I mean, this is just totally intolerable. And this idea that nicking is really what's involved, what's your experience or knowledge of that?
We're well aware of linguistic lies, as I call them. The nicking, the scraping, you know, trying to, this heinous, brutal practice, sexual assault on a child, and trying to equate it with male circumcision. It is absolutely a brutal, brutal practice. It is not a nick. It is a cutting that causes enormous bleeding, It is done with crude instruments with no anesthesia. We will see, and we are introduced to those, you know, whether they're defendants trying to defend this practice or oftentimes the left.
Now, this, let me just be clear about this, Liz. The left has for a long time professed to be the defenders of women and their rights. And this would seem to be utterly incompatible with any such posture. Am I missing something?
No, but as you know, Frank, cultural diversity is now number one, way above domestic violence of women, a sexual assault of children. And as a result of that, the left has been silent, largely silent on this issue. We've seen the ACLU advocate on behalf of protecting this procedure in the hands of immigrants. And it's shocking to me, you know, the feminists who portray themselves as protecting women and little girls in this sexual assault world that we are seeing unfolding are virtually silent.
Yeah. Liz, speaking of sexual assault, I understand that next week in this case in Michigan, the defense is going to try to get the judge, the presiding judge, to strip out one of the charges, and a particularly important one, in which this brutal behavior, there are several girls most immediately now have been mutilated and this case involves, but I gather there are a lot more apparently also who have been mutilated by this ring that is alleged to have done this thing. Talk, if you would, about this whole issue of sexual assault. And is that not absolutely what this involves?
At NFGM today, my team of child advocates are really tracking closely this important prosecution of first impression. And we're learning a lot because on Tuesday, Frank, in federal court in Detroit, where there are eight defendants, they're facing various charges relating to a conspiracy to commit female genital mutilation. The court is going to rule on the defendant's motion, whether count six of what is a superseding indictment. For the layman, this means that they are continuing to uncover more and more victims. They're arguing that this count six, which deals with the defendants, Dr. Nagawale, who has been responsible for FGM on at least six victims, and the owner of the clinic with conspiring to transport minor victims from Minnesota to Michigan for the purposes of engaging in the abuse of female genital mutilation. Now, the defendants, Frank, are asking the court to dismiss this charge because they say that there is no evidence that these defendants were, quote unquote, sexually gratified when performing the procedure of female genital mutilation on these girls. This is a standard of proof, Frank, that is not required under the statute. The statute said all they have to prove is that these children were degraded, abused, or humiliated. And clearly, the facts support that. But this is the thing that we're learning a lot about, Frank. We're learning about what I call the underground trafficking network of female genital mutilators, the conspiracy. And it's no wonder that it's taken 21 years since the federal female genital mutilation was passed in Congress to finally see a prosecution.
Yeah, the prohibition on it has gone unenforced to this point, contributing, I'm afraid, to the kind of widespread problem that you've talked about, Liz Yore. And I just have to say, the idea that this isn't sexual assault because the perpetrators didn't get some pleasure from it kind of misses the point that it sure must have seemed like assault on the little girls who have been brutally violated in this fashion. Liz, we are hard out of time. We have to go. I know this won't be our last conversation about this. I, again, appreciate so much the work you're doing at EndFGM Today. Folks, find more about it at endfgmtoday.com. Liz Yore, glad to have you with us, and I know you'll come back to us, and I hope the rest of you will do the same Monday, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.